Hi, Dan.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
Really good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thank you. Dan, really appreciate you you joining me on the podcast today. I know you've got a lot on right now, so I appreciate the time you're taking. So look, without further ado, we'll get straight into things. Just to really quickly introduce you, Daniel Doherty, one of the senior leaders in the recruitment function at Cognizant. You look after the junior lateral pillar. Just to kick things off, Dan, can you just give us a little bit of an insight to your role? What you're up to at the moment?
So I moved to Cognizant May 2021. So it's been over just a year. And looking after junior lateral recruitment pillar, which focuses as a complementary function to the traditional early careers options for the business, but also supports the experienced hire pillars as well, who traditionally focus on those sort of more mid and senior grades. So hiring a lot of technical talent consultants and business roles.
Good stuff. So in regards to volume, you know, to get a bit of an insight to numbers, what does that look like? What's the kind of scale of the operation?
I mean, across our whole recruitment function, we probably would be hiring upwards of 2,000 people per year. So it's quite a large in-house team. We're probably one of the few sort of larger tech corporates that have that full in-house kind of control and management of that sort of demand and recruitment delivery to the business. So large team, quite tight-knit, and great place to work. Enjoying it a lot so far. Yeah.
Good stuff. So Dan, we're on the podcast today to talk about a really interesting topic, actually. So we've titled it Quick Wins in Attracting Talent. We're not going to necessarily double down on junior lateral or early careers. I think it's going to be slightly kind of more broadly focused. We might kind of double down on some of that stuff. But I think there's two areas that we were quite keen to talk about, the kind of pre-live part of the process in attracting talent, and then the go live. They're obviously very different parts of the process with kind of different streams running through each. So if we kick off, quick wins in attracting talent, but if we can double down for a minute on the pre-live activity, you know, what's your kind of general advice and thoughts on what you could be doing to up your game on attracting talent from a pre-live point of view?
Yeah, so I think it's what I'll talk about is probably just more of those sort of marketing principles, really. And a lot of what we discuss over the next 20 minutes or so are probably applicable and can be applied into multiple sectors, industries, and even grades of talent, not just into early careers, junior lateral, or experienced hire. So if we kind of take it back a few steps, if you think about recruitment as that consumerism cycle from awareness and engagement and decision making right the way through to advocacy, it's all kind of what we're all doing it right. It's a wheel and a cycle that effectively, regardless of who you are, in-house, RPO, agency, we're trying to find those advocates of the future, which can reduce costs and reduce times to hire and support the employer brand side of things. And I think there's less focus on pre-live. So that whole awareness and engagement piece, there's too much focus maybe on, or too much weighted focus on the actual like go live, just get it out there, just be quick. But actually you could end up saving sort of time and money by actually making some time at the start to sort of make time back. So by doing that, and in terms of pre-live, just to kind of explain it, it's going to be all that activity before you literally press that post out to job board or out to your communities that you've built or pipelines that you might have built. Yeah. So it's not in the public domain effectively. So if we kind of go through some of these aspects and topics, and again, these are just some of the practices that I've kind of come across or seen sort of teams do well over the years. So, even way back towards the process step of gathering requirements from the hiring manager or receiving them, are we doing enough really as recruiters to challenge things like the level that the role is at? If you are in-house or supporting a business externally, you know, have you got that kind of clout and credibility and data and market insight to challenge them and sort of understand whether this could be a role brought in at a lower grade, and be receptive to the challenges that might come through that.
Yeah.
In terms of their, there might be some elitism, there might be some almost common sort of, this person was this grade, they might have left or move on into another role in house. They therefore need to be backfilled by that level. It's almost yeah. like becomes a factory line or a process that's kind of inbuilt, just status
yeah.
quo.
Yeah.
And when you actually look at things like, if you talk about the tech space at the moment, of the most in demand roles, the top 10, there's been a over 600% rise in vacancies in this space year on year. So actually, if you look at the actual seniority of those roles, there's an 8-to-1 ratio of mid slash senior versus junior slash entry roles. Wow. And if we're talking about tech talent pyramids and skill shortages, that's not right. The pyramids are upside down, or they look more like a scarecrow, you know, than what they should do. And until we can switch that ratio around, we're going to find it even increasingly more difficult, because there's lots of people leaving sectors at the moment and not yeah. staying in the same sectors. There's not enough coming organically through the subject matter, you know, the educational routes into yeah. into our sector as well.
I suppose in that same vein, Dan, I suppose it needs to be the job of the recruiter internally, or the agency, if that's the route that the company's going down, to challenge some of those preconceptions, because hiring managers will come to the table with preconceptions. There's going to be bias, you know, from their previous kind of successes, failures, whatever, that they've had in the hiring process for similar jobs. But I think so many recruiters would probably go to that table and sit with that hiring manager, and it becomes a bit of a note taking exercise, doesn't it? Say, yes, okay, fine, you want that, and this is what we need to do. But like you're saying, if there's any way of that pyramid getting actually being chucked upside down, which it needs to be, you know, to fill out the bottom, like you've mentioned, I think pushing back on these hiring managers and actually having data to support your argument as well, going prepared to those meetings, you know, to make sure that you've got some well-found out and research data is critical, isn't it?
I think so. I think, I mean, if you were to go to a restaurant, you're expecting to see a menu, right? And if the hiring manager is effectively the consumer there, then they kind of know what they're getting. They're used to it. They've been there before. They've seen a menu similar at another chain. It's kind of like, okay, well, you're actually in control as the restaurant owner here, as the chef. You know, if they need an extra bit of spice in here, if they need a different ingredient there, if actually there's something new, innovative, a new meal that's been created, a new type of talent or a new makeup of talent, which is different to what they've considered before, until you raise that or promote that to them, they're not going to know, because they just go to restaurants as a small percentage of effectively their job. Recruitment is a tiny fraction of what most of the hiring managers are doing. It's not their BAU. They don't live and breathe it. They don't read, you know, their LinkedIn algorithm is differently made up to ours. It's, you know, I think we need to kind of have a little bit more of a, dare I say it, kind of backbone to sort of say, you know, this is what you could win, but these are also the things that you could also engage with and potentially hire. So being that trusted advisor, you know, not telling them that what they're doing is wrong, but giving them additional menu options.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So looking at this pre-live activity then, obviously there's the hiring manager receiving the spec, having those conversations. Is there anything else in that pre-live part of the process where you think, you know, it'd be worth doubling down on?
Yeah, I think terminology is a really important one. We read about a lot of analysis about different demographics, genders, etc., who might perceive or receive information differently based on some of the terminology used. And there's some great tools out there to make it more attractive or more equal footing for different audiences. But even going back to the very basics, you know, if you've got a DevOps engineer or a consultant, and your role is suggesting that in effect the activities or the projects or the doing is relatively similar, but the level of responsibility and accountability is different, are you actually dumbing down the roles by grades and increasing the roles of seniority, increasing terminology based on seniority, or are we just expecting there to be a consulting JD or a DevOps engineer that just one size fits all but covers a salary band which is ridiculous. So I think the onus really then is on the recruiters to be the recipients of that info in whatever format, to be able to wrap it around, top and tail it with the employer branding side of things, but importantly, don't overestimate the importance of the terminology. That first descriptive adjective ownership style word in each of those bullets in the role and requirements, does it say support or own? Does it say contribute to or accountable for? Does it say lead / manage, or does it say part of? That will really give somebody understanding of, and manage in effect your own expectations, so that when a person applies, your pipeline becomes more and more relevant because they've deselected themselves from the roles which are too above their station, or they've selected themselves in because actually this role is at the mid-senior grade that they are actually at, and it doesn't feel like they're going for a role which is a sideward or backward step. So it works both ways up and down the ladder, really, for me. Make sure you look at the descriptive words.
And I suppose if you've got any chance of kind of, hiring, more diverse, teams of people into your business, taking time, care and attention into that partner process is essential, isn't it? Because if you've got the, if you can soften things slightly where you'll be supported, through the process, and we'll help you get up to speed in these areas. For example, there's statistics out there about women applying for jobs, and unless they are ticking, the boxes of, I feel like I can do like 90-95% of all that stuff. If I'm only ticking 80-85% of those boxes, you can count me out. I'm not applying. So it's really important, isn't it? Not just from a diversity standpoint, but to make it a fair process for all.
Exactly. And even if you find that actually it's in one of those kind of grades or seniorities, which they might do a bit more of one thing and not the other, depending on how things play out, depending on their strengths, their experiences, it's very quick and easy for you to just put, contributing or supporting with a view to leading on in the future. It manages that kind of expectation. Okay, well, there's no time frame around it, but I could then move into a role which allows me to then become a leader in a development team or whatever. It's not just this is the exact and closed off kind of expectation, but this is what the art of the possible could be. It also, obviously, from an employer brand perspective, showcases the internal sort of progression routes and the focus on developing talent in-house and things like that by showcasing and future-proofing those roles.
Yeah, and I think it communicates a bit of empathy as well, doesn't it? Do you know if the wording on your job descriptions is you need to have this, you must have this, we as opposed to kind of saying, look, join us and we'll go on a journey with you. We'll help you, we'll support you. We're not expecting the finished article day one. I think just a softened narrative that just shows a little bit of empathy, and you can even talk about the empathy in the job post. And it's like, you don't need to be the finished article. Our job is to go on a journey with you, help you through this process, and da da da. We'll help you get to it. But people warm to empathy, don't they? And I think that's missed a lot of the time, isn't it?
It is, and I think it ties into things like essential versus desirables. If there are sort of non-negotiables based on, any sort of nuances or client-facing requirements or something, they have have X, Y, Z, but it's okay if you've got A, B, C, D, and F. I think that also plays into that empathy as well, because you're restricting the number of essentials and you're maybe expansive on the desirables. It allows people then to be a little bit more informed with them deselecting themselves or selecting themselves in.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So moving on, should we talk about live attraction? And some tips and hints. So moving into live attraction, so you've gone from pre-live and the process that we've been talking about, just their qualifying roles and setting out your stall for a campaign, we're now moving into live attraction. Talk to us about some quick wins that you might suggest there, Dan.
Some of these points are probably in that kind of gray area of pre-live and go live, because you could argue, depending on how sort of structured or well-oiled your attraction is may depend on whether it's set up or it needs to be set up. But things like, you know, your existing talent pipelines and looking at what kind of data you have access to, whether it's through CRMs or whether it's through projects that you've built out on certain platforms. You know, if you've got evergreen requirements, then you kind of know the likeliness or the difficulty rating of that kind of role. If you've kind of built up engagement over time, then obviously it's going to be a lot easier for you to convert them into not just aware or engaged candidates, but actually, you know, live candidates and applicants. And I think you can't underestimate the whole warm versus cold, segregation of talent. So over the years, it's, you know, it's been proven that definitely in projects that I've been on that, candidates who've come through at least one of those kind of prior brand or employer interactions and engagements through digital, face to face, and probably more so digital post pandemic, but are 4 to 6 times more likely to be hired. You know, if you can make your process 4 to 6 times in general more effective from a cost and time to hire perspective, then you know, that's going to be a metric that everybody around you is going to be particularly happy with, I guess. Allows you to do more with less, basically. You know, if you're thinking it and liking it to things like Wimbledon festival tickets, Apple releases, there's a reason why people queue up either on the phone, on a laptop, or outside the premises, because they're fully aware that something's happening, something's coming, something's brewing. I'm not going to say that you're going to have people queuing outside your offices applying for a job that's about to go live. But in terms of its comparison, it's only because their teams have built up that brand loyalty engagement. And there are bigger brands than some of those, you know, who might have more power or clout in the market. But actually, they haven't done the groundwork with the brand and with their engagement with their potential audience. And it loops back around to consumerism. You know, you can't expect to sell something on the shelf unless it's visible or it's been made prominent to the buyer.
Absolutely. And that awareness piece you're talking about there, and you touched on it, but, you know, communicating this stuff continuously to the right audience is the key thing as well, isn't it? Because I think a lot of companies, and you see it, they've got a real broad brush approach, which is it's better than doing absolutely nothing at all. So, you know, I'm certainly not criticizing it, but, you know, making sure you're kind of defining where these people are, you know, what type of content they're more likely to consume, and just making sure you're getting the right messages to them in the right places is probably quite key.
Yeah, I would agree. And I agree with your point around doing something is better than nothing. But, you know, if you look at some of the largest hiring firms or even some of the biggest brands, you might find that their talent marketing is not necessarily in your feed or on your radar, because maybe they've gone about with more segmented talent pipelines based on demographics, location, you know, cold versus warm, passive, active. And building out those sort of data-centric approaches so that they could have multiple streamlined, tailored campaigns happening at once. You know, they might have hundreds of campaigns happening in one sitting, whereas another company might have less resources or maybe more budgets and might go out with, let's target hundreds of thousands of people with an overarching message. Mm-hmm. And actually what that might lead to, without having stats to hand, but I think personally, if a brand spoke to me about trying to, you know, purchase a holiday, and they didn't go into the specifics as to what related to me and my search habits and budgets and things like that, the call to action is just so low.
Yeah.
The conversion rates are so low. And actually, for the same activity with a little bit more time spent to make time back,
could
be a better ROI for you. And the conversion rate should be higher, and it should allow you to do things that are more pressing and urgent, you know, because you've built some time back into the process.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I think another thing that I often see in the attraction process is where, you know, recruiters, internal agency, wherever, and even just general recruitment marketing content, it's so focused on like selling an opportunity. So this is the job, please apply. You know, it's quite salesy. But I think a lot of the time you can create awareness, but just by storytelling, can't you? It doesn't need to be please apply for this job, please apply for this job. The awareness piece could be, you know, a day in the life of, or somebody talking about what they love about the Cognizant values. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it might be, you know, oh, you know, some people in the team did this from a corporate social responsibility perspective, you know, a month ago, and we had some great fun. And people look at that stuff, don't they, and think that's the kind of awareness a lot of people want, isn't it? Because it's not necessarily to drive a call to action there and then, but it's that's the type of company I'm looking to join, actually. And when I'm ready in a month, I'm, as long as the awareness piece is still there, that's the company I'm going to circle back to and apply. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I kind of was just thinking about like how you relate that to non-recruitment world and that whole consumerism piece, because how many things have you bought at the end of the aisle in a shop and then became a loyal customer to that product or that thing? It's normally something that's low in price, it's easily accessible, it's going out of date, it's normally quite a common product.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you were to put like a piece of gold at the end of the aisle and didn't put the price next to it, or the sell by date, people would look at that and be like, I don't know if I can afford that yet, or I want to apply for that yet, or whether it's there's a need for that yet, or I feel like what I would do with that. But there's intrigue created. So your decision making becomes more about multiple. It's encouraging you curiosity wise to then have multiple touch points with the brand, because in effect, you've not shut the door on it and said, do I want that loaf of bread that's going out of date tomorrow? It's 20p, but you know, do I need it? Do I want it? No. And you'll go back to buying your normal brand of bread, because that is what your family eats and it's kind of like the norm. So I think there's an element of like, and I think another thing that we always forget is that the majority of recruitment is in the storeroom and not the shop window, right?
Yeah, such a good point.
We are literally, most of the actual time is spent on stuff that's kind of coming down the line and, you know, workforce planning and demand, you know, curation and stuff. And actually the roles are not open for that long versus the time it's spent to get the demand over the line, sourcing, interviewing, onboarding. The live bit is, I would say, less than 20% for pretty much every job out there. And maybe exec roles, perhaps a longer search, a search period, but consumers, candidates will only see that little bit that's on your website or on, and you're expecting them to all be waiting there for the page to refresh.
Doesn't
work like that, you know. You have to be a little bit more, you know, utilize things like split testing, which I think we'll probably go on to in a second anyway, to see what works, particularly if you've got new requirements, new locations, new grades, new skills. Your brand doesn't normally recruit in that space, you know. You've got to kind of cut through the noise. You have to do things a bit different to get different results, I guess.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. Something else that you and I have spoken about previously, and I think we kind of share the same kind of sentiments around this, but it's probably worth sharing. But the importance of not only trying to attract people, but, you know, in the attraction process, ironically, the importance of maybe putting some people off, you know, that aren't, you know, letting people know that this might not actually be for you. You know, stop casting your net so ridiculously wide that you're going to have so many different people to filter through that so many won't actually be quite right, and they won't actually enjoy the, you know, that place. Doesn't matter who you are or where you are, you know. So the importance of putting some people off, you know, is probably quite an important part of the process, isn't it?
It is. It's massively efficient as well. If you think about like the funnel and you know, your conversion rates will be so much stronger that you've effectively allowed a candidate to deselect themselves by putting in the shop window in front of them what you kind of want them to see and what they are expecting to see.
Yeah.
And sometimes expectations, we wouldn't have a job, right, in recruitment if every candidate and every employer was a good fit for each other, because effectively they'd just be Tinder for recruitment, right? And algorithms and data would just basically do the job for us, and there'd be no recruitment industry at all.
Yeah.
So I know that sounds quite simplistic, but the point being that, you know, it's fine if you are putting candidates off, not because you're putting negative vibes out, it's just because at this time of their career or for this salary level or for this grade of responsibility, we go back to, you know, the terminology being used, just give them as much clarity and transparency as possible. And then there is less Reneges, there is less attrition, you know, there is better expectation management. And then when we go back to consumerism, you should find a richer and larger pool of advocates, which in theory should drive more organic referral and network kind of traffic towards your brand, you know, which doesn't really cost you much, or if anything.
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of minutes ago, you touched very briefly on split testing. So just before you go into that, can you explain what split testing is and where you've done it previously, and some, you know, how somebody that hasn't done split testing in the live attraction process can maybe get started?
Yeah, really simplistically, it's a method which you can use to advertise either roles or awareness. So if you go back to the awareness stage, you could try split testing different advertisements, and that could include wording, pictorial, creative brand. You know, is there certain messages which get a better kind of awareness, reach and click through rates and calls to action, and in theory hires. They all go to the same destination, they all go to the same role that you're advertising. So actually you can manage that and measure that all the way through. All the way through to then, you know, actually going out with the same role but with different job titles. So it might be that you're actually not sure whether you want somebody who's a manager grade or a senior associate grade, or whether you want somebody who's a junior level or an apprentice, you know. It could allow you then to have dual talent pools and in theory test the market out to see what exactly is available. It might enable you as a recruiter to help you have some of those easier conversations going forward, where they can downgrade some of the roles, in fact, or maybe some roles need to be upgraded because the talent doesn't exist at that level and expectations are being mismanaged. So split testing can work really well in the short term as well. As a quick fix, it's one of the better ones from a personal experience, because particularly if you've got a new role, a new sector, a new geography, you don't really know what the talent market looks like for that pipeline upcoming. And the slight change of one word in the job title, you know, having a look around the patch, looking at what other roles with similar job descriptions are titled and labeled as. Even ironically in recruitment, do you go talent acquisition or do you go recruiter? What are people searching by? Search terms differ by geographies as well. Even things like, years ago we looked at for hiring people into London in mid and senior technical roles. We actually found there was a surge of people applying for London roles, not in London, but where it was Liverpool and Bristol. Why? I don't know. But Google Trends will tell you that stuff. So split testing based on either data or the unknowns can be quite useful, particularly for early and junior level roles which have a lot of ambiguity in their title. You know, an SAP technical applications consultant, to anybody that's not reasonably seasoned in the tech industry, means zero to no one. And you're expecting someone to then go below the above the line marketing to invest a few more seconds of their much needed multi-purpose time. They're not going to give you that because you've not hit them in the face with the above the line marketing strap line role title. So make it easy, really, you know. Same with a product on the shelf or a book on the shelf. Like, can they on the back of that work out whether they want to read that book? Because they're not going to spend the next week reading it unless they get into it, you know.
I read something recently, I can't remember who wrote it, but if you can't, I'll tell you who it was. It was the chap, I forget his name, but influencer across multiple social channels, the head of social at Gymshark, just left. He's going somewhere else. Seems like a great guy, posts some great content. But he wrote, and as a piece of advice actually put on LinkedIn today, he did like a 20 bullet point, you know, these things have helped me in my career type thing. But if you can't condense it in it and explain it to anybody in a tweet, then just don't put it out there. And that kind of, you know, that kind of resonated with me, because if you can't, like, you know, put it into however many characters you're allowed now on Twitter, I don't know. But if you can't condense even the job, pretty much the title and, you know, at a very high level, what you'd be doing in that job into a tweet, just don't put it out there.
I'd liken that to kind of, you know, you look on your, you know, your TV and you look at, you know, a Netflix, a Sky or whatever, and there's so many options, right? But why do you stop and stare at something? It might be because the percentage of what you viewed already is an influence. But if you think about the way it's packaged up and the short bio, you know, bio and synopsis, you know, there's a reason those are short, snappy and to the point and they don't be fluffy. And, you know, I'd say that that's likened to the job title. You know, does it make sense? Does it ring true? And if it is uber niche and actually the people that you're trying to attract do search for those terms, then go for it. Even if it doesn't make sense to you as the recruiter because it's unknown territory, then go with the data centric approach, because what else can you go on, really? You can't argue with the market if the market is giving you the data. The guy I think you're on about was Alfred Samba, I think.
That's right, from... Alfred, 100%.
No, his content's great. Follower of his.
So it was, and it's only today actually. And on that whole split testing kind of methodology, you can do it across everything, can't you? So your job adverts, your job titles, your recruitment marketing content, you know, your employer brand strategy, you know, and you know what you know what that overarching strategy looks like. You know, does A work better than B? You know, you should probably start applying split testing to most things that you do, shouldn't you?
All types of content media, not just the job description. As I say, the programmatic ads that you might send to the same audience to work out in the first hour or two which ones buy, you know, no different to Google AdWords and putting together a campaign for that and working out what people are searching by and clicking on and then getting rid of the ones which are not performing as well. It's some of it is trial and error. You know, we're not going to have the solution for everything, but there's definitely tools at your disposal which cost zero in terms of actual software kind of purchase, you know, in terms of Google Trends or looking at analytics on sites and boards or utilizing account managers for inventory and partnerships to work out what's best to lay this out or describe it. You know, don't just, I think, going back to the top of the conversation around pre-live and prerequisites with and requirements from hiring managers, like, don't just take that verbatim. Like, I'd be very surprised if a hiring manager that's not in recruitment gives you the polished, fully fledged go-to-market version of what the messaging should be. Unless they are uber savvy or used to be in recruitment or marketing, I wouldn't expect that from them. And I think that's where there's always been this age old debate about whose job it is between job descriptions and what goes out to market. Recruiters, in my opinion, always have and will be the ones responsible for that, because would you let your engineer who designed your product let you design the packaging?
It's such a good point. So you definitely wouldn't.
And I'm not just talking about technical people or anything like that. I'm just generally saying, like, they are an expert in that field. We're meant to be experts in ours. So everyone club together and control the bits that they own, really.
I agree. So anything else on live attraction, quick wins, anything else that you wanted to add to that?
I do like the thing you mentioned around, you know, anything you could put into a tweet, going with that kind of like simplicity, being able to kind of arm yourself with versions of those kind of ads and job descriptions so that you've got high level, more detailed, having multiple ways of them finding out about the same call to action. You know, really important, because not everybody consumes info on the same channel in the same way with the same concentration span. So, you know, what works for one won't work for all.
Yeah, absolutely. So around live attraction, Dan, we've spoken about a number of things. Any other kind of final thoughts, hints or tips around, you know, quick wins in live attraction?
I think, you know, if you don't have that referral program, you know, sort of underway, and whether it be utilizing sort of quick refers or whether it's leveraging the campaign models, is really, you know, fruitful and useful. Obviously, you don't want to be in a position where you're reliant upon the referral community from a non-divergent thinking perspective and an innovative, you know, sort of reduced point of view. But it's definitely an advocacy exercise. It's definitely a way to tap into some networks that you as recruiters might not have the clout or influence or knowledge of. And I think making sure that, you know, leveraging those people in the first 3 to 6 months of joining as well is more fruitful than any other period. So yeah, don't forget about your referral programs, but don't rely on them either.
Yeah, no, really, really good advice. Okay, great. So I think that kind of caps us off on the live attraction piece. And that was awesome. So just to round things off, and this is kind of a new segment of the podcast, Dan, but I was going to round things off with a question. But at Cognizant, how do you avoid being employer bland? Have you got any kind of overarching kind of thoughts or feelings on that topic?
I think there's this other kind of age old comparison between employer branding and recruitment marketing, and there's lots of people who've got, I guess, lots to say about it. And it can be quite grey area and blurred lines, and they're not always housed in those skills in the same teams and the same structures in every company. But I think if you look at it generally as a recruiter, even if you're not a marketer by trade or by skill set, to me, the simplistic way of kind of describing the two really is to make sure that you know that the employer branding part is effectively the bait when you go fishing. Okay. It's what they're going to see, you know, in this analogy, sort of taste, feel, going to do with it, and what they kind of see and hear. Whereas actually the marketing is just as strategic, really, but it involves understanding what kind of fish you're going after. Do they swim in one lake or multiple lakes? Is it certain times of day? Is it certain types of bait that they prefer? You know, how hard do they bite, and do they come back for additional, you know, do they like multiple types of bait? Is it that they're transfers into multiple types of content and different channels? That kind of analogy around fish means they might re-enter the lakes as well, but are they re-entering through the same entry routes, or are you then finding yourself not covering your own exposure in multiple lakes because you're fishing in just the one? So yeah. I think making sure that you define the difference between recruitment marketing and employer branding as close aligned as they are to non-recruitment people, I think when you're in recruitment, you can definitely see the difference between the two.
Yeah, it's really good advice, because I think the lines are so often blurred between the two activities, aren't they? But like you were saying, it's we're talking about one lake, but then you touched on the point there's multiple lakes, and I think that's the point that a lot of teams miss as well, isn't it? That the people that you really, or the fish that you're trying to catch, you know, they could be in so many other different types of lakes, and it's about making sure you're doing your research, understanding where they're more likely to be, the type of content that they're more likely to latch onto. And I suppose the A-B testing, it comes back to that A-B testing thing, doesn't it? Because when you're talking about the branding, you know, the bait, the different pieces of content, the number of different lakes, the different kind of depths of waters in the lake and all this other stuff, the A-B testing point that you discussed earlier, that becomes kind of vital in understanding, you know, the strategy piece around recruitment marketing, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah, and it will be forever, you know, as effectively lakes and the environments around them change, as does recruitment and sectors. There'll be new ways of catching fish, there'll be new types of bait and packaging it up, there'll be different types of fish, new breeds, which we don't currently categorize them by. So I think you're forever looking around the patch. You're kind of, from a recruitment marketing point of view, helicopter view, looking down going, right, we know that lake's not going to give us that kind of fish, but this one does. So let's put our efforts into that. Whereas actually the people you're working with, and often it's the same person, covers recruitment marketing and employer branding, which again is a separate session altogether. But I think there's a lot of overlap, and don't find yourself with an amazing, you know, sets of different bait if you don't know where to put the bait.
Yeah.
And similarly, if you have got really poor bait, but you're spending so much time navigating and working out where to put it, and the fish don't bite, you're literally at a loss on both fronts. So there needs to be, yeah. You probably have better off having okay base and an okay understanding. Whereas if you've got great and poor on either, questions will be asked and results won't come through.
Great advice. Really, really good advice. And a great point probably for us to kind of cap things off on. So thanks so much for taking some time out, Dan. Really appreciate it. And look forward to catching up with you soon.
No, I really enjoyed it, Chris. And thanks for inviting me on, and see you soon.
Yeah, take care. See you soon. Cheers, Dan.
See ya.